could be stress. There could be like a gut health issue going on. It could be a sleep issue, like sleep apnea. What is your ultimate cause of insulin resistance?
Welcome back to the Healthy Diabetic Podcast. As always, before we get started, please remember that nothing that you hear on this podcast should be considered medical advice or otherwise. Please always consult your medical team before making any changes to your diabetes management. All right, just a couple quick updates for you guys before we jump into today's incredible guest. If you haven't seen yet, the podcast Instagram page is now moving to my Instagram coaching page. So Coach Ken, it's K with the number 3 and then N, Coach Ken. All my updates for the podcast, all the diabetes insights that I put out, all the education I'm putting out is going to be in one platform now. So if you guys haven't seen that on Instagram, make sure you go over and follow my coaching page, Coach Ken, and get all the diabetes podcasts and diabetes coaching insights and that I'm putting out. So I'm putting out a lot of stuff right now. Also, if you haven't checked out the Diabetes Performance Journal that is out on Amazon, it's a really cool performance journal for diabetes. It allows you to track everything you're doing, your diabetes down to your carb counting, your nutrition, your bolus and basal, all your total insulin for the day. It has mindset prompts to get you set up and ready for the day. Just so much incredible value. I've spent so long, probably close to almost a year and a half, just working through that information and making sure that it is really valuable and important when we talk about tracking. Like, so all the things in that journal, it's a 30-day journal. You can get it on Amazon. I really appreciate if you guys go check it out and see what it's it's all about. So it's a really cool 30-day journal. I'm really proud of that thing. I spent so much time on it. So I'm excited for you guys to dive into that journal. And then last update for today, make sure that you go on the coaching page on the website. There's a bunch of links for my 10-week coaching program. I'm only taking a couple more people. I'm almost totally full, so this is super exciting for me. Just so many great people have been able to go through this program and just change their life with diabetes, change their life. The biggest thing that we really focus on in that 10-week program is figuring out what works for you. You guys have heard me talk about this so many times, work through your 5 pillars. And we're going to come up with strategic strategies for you to live your life the way you want to live. Not the way your doctor says you should live. Not the way that other people tell you should live. How is your life structured right now? And how can we make diabetes work the most efficiently and the best for your life? That's what that program is all about. It's an incredible program. Make sure you guys go check that out. There's also a link in the show notes for all this stuff. For the my Instagram page, which has just been updated for the Diabetes Performance Journal and for the coaching program. So make sure you guys go on there and check that stuff out. All right, let's dive into today's guest. I got to sit down with Emily Cornelius. She's a registered dietitian. She's been a registered dietitian for 10 years. She owns her own private practice called Glucose Nutrition. I just love that name, Emily. That's amazing. I love it. Glucose Nutrition. Where she helps women from all forms of life with insulin resistance and losing weight. One of the biggest things that I really took away from my conversation with Emily was that she was another dietitian coming from the clinical setting, which is like, this has probably been close to 10 now that I have talked to over the past 2 months in terms of nutritionists and dietitians and NPs that have left the clinical setting. And that's telling me one thing, folks. That's telling me that these amazing individuals, that doctors, these NPs, these dietitians that we are in front of in the medical system, don't feel like they have enough time to help us. So this is the best time. If you're struggling with nutrition, if you're struggling with diabetes, if you're struggling with insulin resistance, this is the best time for you to hire a coach, because you're not getting the care that you need from the doctor's office. They just don't have enough time. They're not set up to help on a grand scale. So that is one of the biggest things I took away from my conversation with Emily. She is such a fascinating dietitian. We align so much in our viewpoints. We talked about so many different things. We start this conversation out with CGM, and that's probably like a 5 to 7 minute conversation on both of our personal thoughts on CGM and how it can be used not just for type 1 diabetes, but also for non-insulin dependent diabetics, to pre-diabetes and type 2 diabetes. So just such a fascinating conversation with Emily. I'm so excited to share this conversation with you guys. Okay, I'm going to stop talking now and bring on Emily. Thank you so much, everybody, for continuing to listen. You guys continue to make this worthwhile, showing up for you every single week. So I really appreciate all of you. So without further ado, let's get with Emily Cornelius. I think that CGM is the new wave of health. Optimal health is CGMs is how we're going to identify that. Because like it's incredible for me to look at, like when I eat, you know, something, when I eat, let's just say a piece of pizza, and where mm-hmm. that insulin spike goes and how it goes compared to when I just exercised or not exercised, compared to if I got a really, really good night of sleep or didn't get a good night of sleep, you can see that stuff through the CGM. And like you can, and on top of that, because I've seen my colleagues at the gym who have worn the Abbott Libre and use these other systems, you can see that stuff so well for non-insulin dependent mm-hmm. diabetics. Because these other factors that are involved that, yeah, we have to deal with as a type one, but at the end of the day, like if you're going to have an insulin spike, you're going to have an insulin spike. If you don't pre-bolus, or if you don't give yourself enough time, or if you don't give yourself enough insulin, you're still going to have some type of a spike. But it's incredible to see the difference in terms of like all the other factors that are going to affect blood sugar and how, you know, if you don't take in those things into account. So I just believe that CGMs at some point are going to be pushed into the general public of non-insulin dependent diabetics. And I still can't believe that they're not readily available for type 2 diabetics. That's insane to me that they're not.
Yeah. The continuous glucose monitors. I know. And I don't know. I'd be interested to hear what you heard, because I've heard on my end that from continuous glucose monitor companies, because I was talking to a lot of them when I was trying to figure out which one to bring into my practice. And they were saying there's no shortage of continuous glucose monitors. It's the doctor's issue of like paperwork and coverage. It's like all the loopholes that they have to go through. And so I think there's a big misconception on like social media, because I've shown myself wearing a continuous glucose monitor before. And there's this group of people that will just get so upset with me because they say like, it's not available for them. But if you pay out of pocket, you can get it. It's more about like insurance coverage and stuff like that. Is that what you've heard also?
As someone with non-insulin dependent diabetes, we're fighting two uphill battles, right? We're fighting the insurance companies because they're not allowing type 2 diabetics or non-insulin dependent diabetics to really use them and get the same type of coverage that type 1 diabetics are getting. That's the first hurdle that we're trying to overcome. Now, maybe if you have like really good insurance and you work for like a humongous company or something, then maybe that insurance will do it. But most private insurances, most insurances aren't covering them for non-insulin dependent diabetes. The other uphill battle we fight, and I know this for a fact because I talk to my friends that are reps for Dexcom, that like you said, there's doctors and physicians and practitioners that don't believe in using the CGM, don't see the value out of the continuous glucose monitors, which just blows my mind. I don't understand that. So I've had really good conversations with these reps. And we're even talking insulin, or not insulin, but pump reps as well. Insulin pump reps, that they're fighting tooth and nail to get these devices into these doctors and in these offices, because some doctors don't believe that there's a real value out of this technology, which is that's crazy to me. So those are the two biggest uphill battles we are facing right now with continuous glucose monitors, which is completely asinine to me when we think about even just the subtle differences, because there are subtle differences between type 1 and type 2. There's very subtle differences. Mm-hmm. For the most part, like, the management style and the philosophies and concepts, I believe, are kind of the same, but how you go about it is a little bit different. And for someone to say that a non-insulin dependent diabetic can't get value out of knowing what their blood sugar is when they have blood sugar issues because they're insulin resistant, that's crazy to me that we're really making that conversation or making that argument. That's insane.
Yeah, that is really wild. It is so beneficial for everybody in different ways, but I definitely have like several client stories relating back to that with things we've found just with the monitor, which is really mind blowing. But have you heard, I'm curious, what Apple's working on?
Be more specific, because I might have.
Okay. Well, I heard that I read some stuff online too, that they're working on some sort of way to read blood sugar through the Apple Watch, I think it would be. I don't know if it'd be a separate technology or through the watch, but it would be available to everybody. But I'm curious as to like what the accuracy would be on that, like when they figure it out.
I will not try to sit here and say that I know anything about that technology, because I don't. But what I do know about the technology that's readily available right now, excuse me, for continuous glucose monitors like the Dexcom, let's use that as the example here, it's not 100% accurate all the time. And you have this plastic needle inside the muscle tissue that if there's hard, dense tissue and that thing's trying to get through there, you're not going to have very good accurate readings because you don't have enough blood flow to where that needle, plastic needle is. So we already know that, right? It's not 100% reading the cell of the red blood cell, or it's not reading from the red blood cell because it can't automatically 100% get to it. Now, when we talk about the watch, unless they're putting a needle into your arm with the watch, like, how is it measuring that? It's the same thing when we talk about how are they measuring your heart rate, because the heart rate variability of it, once you actually start exercising and sweating, it's not the greatest. I think the newer watches, the new Apple watches are a lot better than the old ones, but still it's not 100%. Like, you're going to still get a much better reading if you're wearing a heart rate chest strap than if you're wearing your watch, 100%. Because I see it every single day, like being in the fitness industry. And so that would be that's what I would be curious to know, is like how they're going to get past that barrier of not being able to get to the red blood cells to actually read what your sugar level is.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I know at one point I was like looking through to see how many articles have been out about Apple working on this. And I think I found something all the way back to like 2008. Like, it's obviously very complicated. This isn't something they just like are starting and going to roll out in a couple years. Like, who knows if they even can do it, but it would be interesting if it comes out and if it was more available to everybody. I think there's going to be a lot of confusion on how to read it.
Well, that's when amazing people like you come into play that can read that stuff. Like, you got this. What's going on here?
I'll be waiting with my course when it comes out.
Emily doesn't want an influx of people. That's great. No, but I think that it's going to be really cool. It's really interesting. I really think that CGM is the wave of the future in terms of us monitoring our overall health from a daily basis, right? Obviously, we can go and get all these amazing blood tests, you know, from the clinical aspect, from the functional aspect, whichever side of the coin you're on and what you believe in, we can get that stuff done. But being able to see what our blood sugar is, even a non insulin or a non-insulin dependent diabetic is so powerful. And I just think that we will learn so much over time about our system and how it works. I mean, even in the fitness industry, we're learning so much, even from just the Whoop. The Whoop is incredible in terms of the information that it's giving to people. Same with the Apple Watch. It really has been mind-blowing for people to look at, okay, well, they've got really good information on sleep because you're wearing the watch all night. Like, so there's some really cool things happening right now. And I'm waiting and praying for CGM to be the next big thing for overall health that's being, you know, I don't want to say monetized, but being brought to the general public and just being pushed out to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And I just try to raise awareness too. It's definitely viewed as an expensive thing to have. To people who are not diagnosed with diabetes, it's definitely, you have no chance of getting coverage if you're not diagnosed as diabetic with the monitors. But it's the customization, the level of customization I can do with clients when they're wearing those. And my program one-on-one is 3 months. It's insane. It takes it to the next level. We can see in real time if the interventions are working. There's no more guesswork as to what's going on. We know exactly what's going on. Clients can do those adjustments right away and start getting weight loss right away. And so even though it is an investment, it's worth the investment to just wear it for, I think everyone should wear it for a few months to just learn about their patterns, the way they're eating, their stress, their lifestyle, to see how it is impacting their health. I really agree with that.
Yeah. I think about these amazing dreams of just walking down the street and seeing everybody have a Dexcom G7 or an Abbott Libre or hey, cool. What's up? What's blood sugar? My too. Like mine. I just like the wave of the future. Awesome. Everyone's wearing one.
Yeah, that would be cool.
So cool. Well, we talked a lot about blood sugar or about glucose monitors. Let's dive into you, because we're here for you. You're the amazing guest in front of us today. You.
Okay. Thanks for having me on the podcast too. I'm very excited to chat more about blood sugar. My name is Emily Cornelius. I'm a registered dietitian. I've been a dietitian for 10 years. I live in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I started my practice 4 years ago now, I would say. What inspired me to become a dietitian was actually my mom kept telling me that I should be a dietitian, and I really wanted to do business. I was like, oh, I want to do finance or business. And so I went to school for a year for that and realized I'm not very detailed. I'm a big picture person. So the details of the math of finance was so overwhelming for me. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to just go see what a dietitian is all about. And I had thought that they just sit around and write diets all day. So I thought it was very boring. I was like, oh, I cannot do that. But then I found out that there's a lot of different things that you can do as a registered dietitian. You can do food service, or you could work in the hospital, or I have kind of a non-traditional job, I feel like, with social media, but you can have your own private practice. There's just so many areas you can go into. So I thought, well, I'll give it a try. And so I went to school. It takes 4 years to get a degree in it. And then you have to go on and do an internship. And so it was 6 years total for me by the time I had switched my career and started into being a dietitian. And then had a lot of clinical experience before starting my practice. And I started as a macro coach because in school, that's what I was taught, was I wanted to help people to lose weight, and we're taught a macro approach. And so I opened my practice based on macros and calorie counting, and it was okay. It was a little rough at first to anybody starting a business. I feel can relate to that. But my main frustration within my business was there was about 45% of my practice who couldn't lose weight even in this calorie deficit that I had them in. And it was so frustrating because I would be like having people sometimes that maybe did keto and they were down to like 800 calories and they had been doing that for a while. And so their metabolism slowed. So then would have to do this whole reverse dieting, which if whoever's listening, if you're not familiar with reverse dieting, you have to like slowly add calories back in to back them out of this hole and get the metabolism back up to where it needs to be. And then you create a new deficit for them to lose weight in. And the whole process can take a really long time. And people online, like, they already are stretching themselves, trusting that you can help them. And then you have to tell them, well, I have to reverse diet you. And they're like, what? So it was a struggle for that. But also I was just frustrated that some of these people, I just couldn't help them. And my one client that was struggling, she went to her doctor and got diagnosed with sleep apnea. And I pulled out my medical nutrition book and I was looking through, found sleep apnea, and it's a nice book. It like has every medical condition in it and tells you the nutrition therapy for it. And I'm reading through and it just says insulin resistance, like literally all over the page. So I was like, oh, I'm like, wonder if she has insulin resistance. And so, and this is somebody who has a normal glucose, normal A1C, no indication of any type of blood sugar issues. And so we got on a call and I said, I think I know what's going on, but I want to hear from you first, what your thoughts are. And she's like, I want to hear your thoughts. So then we both came to the same conclusion because she had been doing research too, that she had maybe a blood sugar issue. So anyways, she got like the mask, of course, for the sleep apnea, because that was really a big root of the problem, was that her sleep, whenever you're not sleeping correctly, your cortisol can run high throughout the day. And so she was having high cortisol, even eating healthy, balanced meals, she was still having a lot of blood sugar issues. So anyways, back then we did not have continuous glucose monitors. And back then is not that long ago, like two or 3 years ago. They were out there, but I feel like I just had not brought them into the practice. So what we did was we just played with carbs to just see where her tolerance was. And then when we found it and we found the sweet spot, she was losing weight. We just continued to control the carbs, but keep them as liberal as possible in the diet. And then, of course, like we used like healthy fats and fiber-dense carbs. And anyways, now she's down 95 pounds. That's so awesome. I'm excited that she definitely has had so much success just focusing it and shifting into blood sugar control instead of macro calorie counting. And I think a big part of the issue was, even though she was in a deficit, her carbs were too high. Like she could not tolerate the amount of carbs that I was giving her. And so anyways, then I told the other people in my practice who were struggling to lose weight about it, and they went out and got a fasting insulin test. Sure enough, it was like one after the other, just kept coming back, insulin resistant. And I'm like, wow, this is like a big issue. And so I decided, I think I had like 200 followers on Instagram, maybe more than that, not very many. And then I had like maybe 1,000 on TikTok, and I had been working on social media. It wasn't like I wasn't trying. But anyways, I thought, let me just go online and just ask about this. Maybe there's other people out there. And I really didn't know that more than 1 in 3 people now are considered insulin resistant at the time. And so I just started talking about it, and luckily it was like during the end of 2021 when you could just go viral like crazy on TikTok and there was like no limitations, and it just got so crazy. I grew so quickly. And now I have over 750,000 between Instagram and TikTok. And so what amazes me is just that like so many people were relating to that story of struggling to lose weight, not being able to have success, and not even showing blood sugar issues like on a lab mm-hmm. on their labs, in their labs. So, anyways, that's how I got into it. I literally fell into it. And then I got tested. I got my hormones tested and I had like estrogen issues, testosterone issues. I've always struggled with stress and anxiety. And so I started using a bunch of blood sugar balancing strategies and I just feel so much better. I don't have like the panic hungry anymore. And so I think it's so beneficial for, you know, anybody out there to learn more about how to make themselves feel full and satisfied. And I've been getting into some more fasting lately too, which has been awesome. It's been like, it's skyrocketed my energy and it's just been really helpful. So that's basically like how I got into this space that I'm in now.
Wow. So many questions. So many questions. This is awesome because I've been passionate about food for a long, long time. But I never dove into it. And I have always had a small baseline understanding and knowledge. I've got precision nutrition as a nutrition certification, super basic stuff. But about 6 months ago, like I started really diving into food labels for myself and then trying to like relay that information back to like the food that I'm actually consuming and the quality of the food that I'm consuming. So you're talking a lot about insulin resistance and now we're seeing, you know, you made the comment of one out of three people have some type of insulin resistance. My question to you as a registered dietitian, as someone that's very passionate about food, what is your thought process or your philosophy when you're talking to your clients about these blood sugar regulations and their relationship with food and the quality of the foods that they're actually consuming? Are you talking about that type of stuff? Are you diving deep into that? Like, let's switch this out because this is highly inflammatory for this one. Like, are you talking about those types of things?
Yes. Whole foods is like the foundational core of like, any meal plan that I make, it's all whole foods. But then we do use some processed foods here and there because it does help clients as far as like speediness, you know, so that's really tailored per person. But yes, I think whole foods first as much as you can. And there's a huge movement towards more plants. And that's something I find, you know, fiber is a huge deficiency in America. Most Americans are not eating enough fiber every day. And it starts with vegetable intake. I see people are eating two or three servings of vegetable intake, but the recommendation is like six servings per day. And that's the standard. So people are under eating vegetables. And so you may have heard that strategy of vegetable meal starters where you start your meal with a vegetable because the fiber will basically like put up a net in your intestines. And when you put the carbon after that in protein and fat, it kind of falls into that net. And so it helps slow down digestion of the glucose. And so you won't get as big of a blood sugar spike if you're using veggies before a meal. And so on all of my plans, I always make sure clients have for dinner, we just focus on like one meal instead of every single meal. It tends to be like too much. It's like finding that sweet spot of what people can do consistently without feeling overwhelmed. So we just focus on dinner and if they can do more, they can do more. But starting with a vegetable meal starter, it's amazing to see. If you just add that veggie in before dinner, plus you're eating a vegetable at dinner, you're already increasing your vegetable intake for the day. So just having like one place for a vegetable that's consistent has really over a week span increased the vegetable intake by seven servings. So that's kind of what I try to do with clients is find like easy, sustainable ways that they can incorporate more things into their diet that will help them as far as like food goes. But yeah, we definitely focus on like anti-inflammatory, meaning like very low refined carbs. And then As far as sugar goes, I always put desserts on my plans every week for clients, but they are, the sugar is either like monk fruit sweetener, it's like a low sugar. Maybe there's just a teaspoon or two of maple syrup. Like, it's very controlled. And then if they'll end up usually having like a treat once a week anyways, that's not low carb or low sugar. And so, but it kind of helps take the emphasis off of this like treat once a week. If they can have a treat whenever they want, it's just a little bit lower in sugar and healthier for them. So I definitely try to bring like the enjoyment in throughout the week, because I think it's really important for people and mindset and everything like that to stay on track.
I love that you brought up sugar, because it's my next question for you, because you named two different sugars that I would call very good quality sugars. Right. Cause I, for me personally, again, not a dietitian, but I always talk to people about food in with the concept of like, everybody's like calories in versus calories out. You have to create these deficits, which is correct. But at the end of the day, not every calorie is created equal. Not every carbohydrate is created equal. I can have 30 grams of white pasta versus, 30 grams of fruit. It's not going to digest the same, and the white pasta is going to spike you way more than the 30 grams of fruit. So and I talk about the same thing with sugar, because you can have really good quality regular sugar compared to ultra processed sugar, and people don't understand the difference. They just hear like, oh, cut out all sugar, so they just want to cut out all sugar.
Yeah, you're right. There is like a lot of different types, and I think as far as like the sweeteners too, like the monk fruit and stevia and stuff, has been especially stressful as a dietitian, because nutrition is a hard field in a way that it's always changing. As soon as you do something and promote something, another research study comes out, and guess what? That's not right. So if people are frustrated with knowing answers with nutrition, I mean, try living in this space and teaching other people is like so frustrating sometimes. But as far as like sweeteners go, with blood sugar, I do still promote like monk fruit and allulose as like two sweeteners, because there hasn't been negative research yet, because they're newer. So stevia, I mean, definitely impacts the gut. We know that in a negative way. It was on the World Health Organization's list as possibly carcinogenic. Yeah. I can never say that word. So people, it doesn't matter what you think at that point. People saw that on the news and it's in their brains, and that's it. Like, that's one thing I've learned in nutrition is like, they'll ask you, but they're probably not going to bring it back into the diet. And if they're not comfortable, they don't need to. You know, they can use monk fruit sweetener or allulose, because I wouldn't be surprised if we hear stuff about that though in the next however many years. So I just encourage clients to focus on like moderation when it comes to sweeteners and added sweeteners, like try not to use that stuff multiple times a day, and, you know, focus on whole foods, focus on things that can sweeten your foods naturally. That's kind of where my focus is with clients versus those types.
That's interesting
things.
About monk fruit, because I've always thought that monk fruit was like actually a good quality sweetener outside of something like stevia. And like that, I mean, it's interesting that you're talking about like, oh, monk fruit might come out. We don't know, like, that it might come out as not the greatest for you.
Yeah. And I think it's because these stevia is a plant. I used to have like a stevia plant and I would eat the leaves and they were so sweet and good. But maybe it's because they take however many plants that they need to grind it to a powder. And so if you, it's almost like essential oils, like they say, always dilute it, because you might have like 1,000 flowers in that one drop. And, you know, so it's just like a lot. And that's something to keep in mind is like, even though it's like a healthy, natural thing, we're not really eating it from the leaf. We're like processing it. So I think that might be part of the issue.
From the consumer perspective and someone that like really values quality over everything, when I hear the word processed, I get triggered, my brain gets triggered of oh man, this is, yeah. I have to look into this because I want to know how it's being processed. I want to know why it's being processed. And was there really a reason to do that, or are you just doing it to save money?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that we could all do better with knowing like where our food's coming from. We live in, we just have everything at our fingertips. So it's very easy to get disconnected from food.
Interesting. Okay. I want to dive back into insulin resistance because this is a diabetes show and a lot of people resonate with that, with those two words, insulin resistance, especially with people in the type, people in the type one space, but obviously with people in the type two space, which I believe you mentioned that you work a lot with. And my question is, with insulin resistance, is there like a couple things that you could tell the listeners that they could take action on right now that would help them alleviate insulin resistance on a daily basis? Because for me, I look at insulin resistance in two different ways, right? So as a type one, we have insulin resistance because of hardened scar tissue because of constant insulin in that specific place. We've got insulin resistance, and then we got insulin resistance based off of how our body's feeling, or we didn't get enough sleep, or our cortisol levels are high because of stress, or whatever it is. We're insulin resistant because of that. But then we also have insulin resistance because our digestive system and our digestive tract is out of balance because of the food that we're consuming. Where do you agree with that? With both of those statements, one and two, how can we alleviate the quality piece? Is it what we've been talking about where we should just be paying more attention about the quality, or is it being able to have a more balanced diet? Like, what's your thoughts on like, how do we overcome this insulin resistance issue that we really have in America based off of probably the food that we're consuming?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And this will probably go full circle back to the CGM, but there are so many different ways that we can get insulin resistance. Like you were mentioning, it could be stress. There could be like a gut health issue going on. It could be a sleep issue, like sleep apnea. And so I think that that's why it's really important each individual person to decide or work with somebody to figure out what is your ultimate cause of insulin resistance. Like, and how can you focus in that area to correct it? And dietary is a huge part of it, but just working so much with clients one-on-one using continuous glucose monitors, something I see that even when we get the diet correct and balanced, if they have a stress issue and that's the root cause issue, just like my client was talking about with sleep apnea, had she not addressed the sleep apnea, the cortisol would still be running high all day. And even though she's eating balanced, healthy meals, she still has higher spikes because the cortisol issue was never addressed. And so that's where you hear people say, I am eating healthy. I'm doing everything. I'm not losing weight. I'm not getting results. And it's like, well, food often gets blamed, but there's a holistic approach that needs to happen when it comes to blood sugar to figure out what's going on at the root issue. And another example is I had a client that was spiking a lot on legumes, like an insane amount. And they were not a lot either, because everything's carb controlled when I give my plans out. And so it was like she was having over 200 blood sugar spikes, somebody who is not diabetic. And it was just like, I've never seen that before. So I told her, I don't think this is like a normal response. And I think something might be going on more in your gut. And so she worked with a gut specialist and got all the testing done, and here found out she has SIBO. And so her course of action was she actually did need to remove all legumes and grains and let her gut heal. So she went on a protocol for SIBO to heal her gut. And I just heard from her like a few months ago, and she said, I'm eating legumes now and I'm not spiking. And so it's amazing to see that like we are all individuals and we have different stories. And just like you're saying, like your blood sugar tells your story of what's going on or can give you an indication of maybe where the ultimate cause of your insulin resistance is coming from. And so one other quick story, I had a client that was a 911 responder, and I have never seen blood sugar like that. It was like a heart monitor when she went to work, and she was eating healthy and balanced and doing great and very consistent and moving her body. But her stress levels because of her work were so extreme that it was giving her insulin resistance. And so luckily she was close enough to retirement that she ended up retiring early. And how we could really see that is on her days off, her blood sugar was like so much better. And so she was able to raise awareness at the office and tell others like how much the job was impacting them. And she said they do have therapists there, like on staff to help them debrief from these very stressful calls. But it's just interesting because like, I don't have a job like that where I'm constantly, my stress is triggered all day because of traumatic experiences that I have to listen to. So everybody has a different like situation going on, it seems. But I think overall, if I could sum up like two things that I see pretty consistently, I just had one of, I have a membership, and one of the members inside of my membership, she wrote a post on our Facebook community, and she was feeling just frustrated. I think a lot of people can relate to that. She was kind of at this point where she wasn't keeping herself accountable. She was feeling swollen, just like low energy, all this stuff. Like her, she couldn't get her medicine from her doctor for her blood sugar. And so anyways, I followed up with her recently to ask her how things were going, because this was just like, I want to say 2 months ago that she wrote this post where she was in a really bad place. And she said, I'm doing great. She said, my blood sugar's better. I'm losing weight and I still don't have my medication. And I was like, oh, I'm like, wow. I'm like, great job. I was like, well, what's going on? Like, what have you done differently? And she had been doing the program inside the membership, but she said that the top two things that she did that really turned things around for her was having breakfast and lunch ready to go. And I think that this happens a lot. Whenever I get clients to start eating balanced meals consistently, their blood sugar will be all over the place in the beginning. And then as the weeks go on, it starts to get leveled off, and you can almost see it, like, well, you can see it getting better. Consistency matters for blood sugar. If you're not prepared and you're not prepping meals and you don't have them ready to go, you're probably going to snack through that meal or skip the meal. And so if you're inconsistent, then your blood sugar can tend to be like all over the place. So I think consistency is really important. And a big part of consistency is being prepared. And so, and I think for fullness too, because I work with clients who are not, they're pre-diabetic, but they're not diabetic yet. And so I feel like I just lost my train of thought.
I hate when I do
hate
that.
When that happens. But anyways, yeah, like consistency, usually just getting set up with a plan and being consistent is like what really, really helps them to start seeing a lot more consistency with their blood sugar. Oh, I was going to say, feeling full is so important for a weight loss journey and for blood sugar control, to avoid snacking and give your body breaks between meals and stuff like that. And it's different for everybody. For the population I work with, we try to do more fasting. I know like some people with diabetes, it's better if they have snacks between meals. So that's not like a blanket statement for everybody, but what helps them with the breakfast and making sure they get enough protein in the morning and with lunch is it sets them up for the rest of the day to feel full and satisfied, so they're not overeating calories. So I think that that's like preparation and being prepared. If you're not into meal prep, get into meal prep, because it really is a lifesaver.
Yeah. The preparation is, I mean, preparation is incredible because it helps us being able to be prepared for the inconsistency. I love that you brought that up because the inconsistency, especially as type ones, the inconsistency is what kills our blood sugars. Not just even just with not eating the right good quality foods and not getting food, but the inconsistency in our blood sugars happens when we're not prepared for a specific situation. And I love that you brought that up. I want to ask you, because you brought it up a couple times, and I want to get your thoughts, because this is another big hot topic. It's been big hot topic for years, is intermittent fasting. And I would love to know how you use that with your clients, how you're educating them on that, what your philosophies are on intermittent fasting, because everyone has their own thought processes about intermittent fasting and how to use it and what is actually intermittent fasting versus what's not intermittent fasting. I'd love to know your thoughts about that.
So there's a lot of different types of fasting. And I actually have to admit that I was against fasting in the beginning of my career as a dietitian because I felt like consistency was so important for people. And I hadn't really researched fasting on the level of blood sugar. But there's a lot of different ways that you can fast. And it is very important for blood sugar because your body will store glycogen in the liver, which is excess glucose. So if you overeat carbohydrates, your body stores some in the liver. And then once the liver's full, it will store it as body fat, right? So there's two different storage forms whenever you overeat carbohydrates. And whenever you fast, you give your body a chance to utilize the glycogen or the glucose in the liver for energy. And then when it's finished and out of that, it's going to tap into your body fat. And so why that's helpful for insulin resistance is because if you're constantly giving your body glucose, you're never really getting into that deep visceral fat for burning. And why I kind of turned more to a fasting method and why I'm sort of changing things now is because I do coach clients for weight loss in a calorie deficit. Like, let's say they're at like 1700 calories. They're going to eventually plateau on that throughout their weight loss journey because their metabolism always adjusts to what you're doing. And so when I read research, and I don't know if you've read about the failure rate of calorie deficits, 99.3% failure rate for people for calorie deficits. And so that was really frustrating for me to learn as a registered dietitian who had been like building. I mean, that's what I felt like I learned as a registered dietitian is deficits. So I think fasting can play a really awesome role in helping people to create a deficit without having to lower the calories every day. Because if you are doing maybe 5-2 fasting, which is like 2 days of 500 calories and 5 days of just regular calorie intake, you could eat up to 2,000 a day with the two fasting days because you created a bigger deficit. And it also is a nice rest for the pancreas and helpful for reversal of insulin resistance. So that could be a method. I think the 16-8 fasting is the most popular one because people feel like that's doable. They can just skip a meal, and usually people just ditch breakfast, which from what I've read, it's better to skip dinner because your body is resting and relaxing in the evening. So if you can skip dinner instead of breakfast, it can be, I think, even more helpful for weight loss I've seen for clients. But I know dinner is tough for people to do all the time because of families and they want to eat together and like they don't want to have, just sit there and let everybody eat. So that's why I think people have defaulted more to breakfast as like a more convenient meal to skip. But from what I understand, if you're doing like 16-8 fasting, you need to be doing it like more often than if you're doing longer fast days, then you can do less of them and get still the same results. But I think there's so much you can do. You could then just do like 30-hour fasts with no food. You could do 24-hour fasts. You could do, there's always more you can do with fasting. And I know Jason Fung, have you read his books at all?
I know of him, but I have not read his book. Yeah.
He has a great fasting book, and he's on YouTube and talks a lot about fasting and blood sugar. But he's a little bit more extreme. I start clients with gentle fasting is what I call it, just to ease them into it. But he starts people on like 3 30-hour fasts a week. I'm like, wow, it's a lot. Like, you're going to definitely feel dizzy and headache and sickness and all of those types of symptoms if you're going straight in like that. But I definitely think it plays a role in insulin resistance, reversing insulin resistance for sure. How does that, I'm curious to hear, as like a type 1 diabetic, I haven't studied fasting as far as that goes. It's probably a little bit different, I would imagine.
Yeah. This is the slippery slope, right? So I've looked into it. I've dabbled in it myself. There's two things with intermittent fasting, regardless of how you're rolling with it, whether it's a 16-8, whether it's a 24, whether it, I mean, whatever it might be. There's two things that we're fighting as type ones. We're fighting the energy piece, but also we're fighting the blood sugar regulation piece. Because if you're doing, even if you're doing like a 24, there's a high probability that you're going to go hypoglycemia, or you're going to go hypoglycemic, right? And you're going to need to break that fast. You know, so these are the things that are very tricky, because I don't know what the research says. Like, if I'm trying to do a 24, right, and I'm dropping because I don't have enough glycogen on board, because I'm going into muscle tissue and fat tissue to get energy for whatever I'm trying to do, and I'm going hypoglycemia, or I'm going hypoglycemic, and I need to bring myself back up. How does that, like, does that just destroy the whole fast based off of what you're consuming, even if it's 15, 20, 30 grams of something? That's the part I don't really know. Is it really that big of a deal, because you're only doing 15, 30 grams? But then you look at the other aspect, is like, now you're feeding your body, and now your brain is sending those signals of probably going to be hunger signals, because you're actually consuming food. You're actually getting those signals rolling, because you actually had to bring your blood sugar up. So are you fighting those signals? So those are the big questions that I have. And those are the things that I even ran into when I was trying to do 16-8s, is there was so many days when I had to break that fast, because even without exercise, because you put exercise into the mix now, because a lot of people, even type ones, talk to so many people that just, they love to fast, working out. I can't do that because I'll drop in a second. So there's all these things that, as a type one, it's very interesting and curious. And I would be curious to know about that piece about, like, if I have to bring my blood sugar up, even with just 30 grams, am I technically breaking my fast? Is there things physiologically happening when that happens that just alleviates now the potential of all the benefits of that fast? I don't know, because it's only 30 grams as an example, but those are the things that I ran into when I was doing 16-8. What I really like, because I haven't really thought about it, is your thought process of doing 500 and then regular, right? Doing a 500 calorie deficit and then going into a regular, the next day into just a regular caloric intake. That's a really interesting thing, because even thinking about from the diabetic or the type 1's perspective, or insulin dependence perspective, and we're constantly having to put in synthetic insulin, because that's one thing that people don't talk about, right? We need this insulin to exist or to live, but we're also using synthetic fake insulin that's being produced. It's not like it's coming from our own body, and it's not natural to our own body. So I think about things like that, like, you know, in those aspects of being able to even do your 500 to, in having a normal calorie day the next day.
Yeah. I think it's, I'm not sure for type one, like, I would wonder what the ultimate benefit would be. Like maybe it wouldn't be the most effective method for weight loss, but as far as like anti-aging and the other benefits that you can get from fasting, I haven't studied type 1 with fasting, so I'm not really sure. But like you said, it definitely seems like something to be careful about too, because you don't want to get yourself into like a situation. And I know as far as like the 5-2 fasting goes, the 500 calories are all made up of low glycemic. So I've been doing it for about a month, trialing it. And it's like protein, vegetables. I can have like a yogurt with like a little bit of berries on that day. But the idea is to flatline the blood sugar so that your pancreas doesn't have to secrete much insulin for the day. So you're resting it. And so that's why it can be helpful for people who are working on reversing it, reversing insulin resistance. So I'm not sure, like, it'd be interesting to understand, like, what would a type 1 diabetic need as far as fasting, where you could get benefits but not harm yourself as far as like having lows and dealing with all the fluctuations.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because you also talked about weight loss. And I think that the weight loss piece, and on top of that, the digestive rebuilding, or allowing the digestive system to like replenish itself and like heal itself, is another big benefit of intermittent fasting that I've read about. And that goes along the lines of whoever you are, it doesn't matter what condition you have or what's going on in your life. Like that's a huge thing, especially in a world where we are constantly inflamed by ultra processed foods. And I think that just this intermittent fasting concept just really fascinates me, because there are so many benefits, but just like anything, there's other risk factors, at least for insulin dependent diabetics, that based off of how you obviously do it. So yeah.
Yeah. No, it makes sense. I'm sorry, I don't have answers, but, for anybody listening that is a type 1 diabetic, I would start, maybe see if Jason Fung has any information on that, because he is a doctor and he specializes in like insulin resistance fasting. He has a lot of videos online. So maybe check him out and like look and see if he has anything for type 1. I'd be curious to learn if he does that.
Yeah. I wonder if he would accept a message from me and come on the podcast. Yeah, we gotta do that. We gotta get Jason on. Okay. So, all right. So we talked about intermittent fasting. There's another thing that I wanted to pick your brain about, because I constantly go back and forth, or I constantly look at this myself with clients that I'm working with. Is the calorie deficit idea or thought process, right? Because you made a mention about the client that, or that individual that is at 1700, and they're going to plateau at that at some point. Are you playing with that deficit? If their deficit is $1,700 as an example, and you see the signs and the symptoms of plateauing, are you dropping them again? Or are you increasing them a little bit? Or are you playing with both?
That's a good question. And it really depends on like when they plateau, you know? And so I think methods that I've used, well, first we always sit down and we do anytime, I should start with a true plateau is 2 weeks of the same weight. So you have to give yourself at least 2 weeks. Then I always recommend sitting down. And if you're not keeping a record of what you've been doing, you got to keep a record, because everybody thinks that they're more consistent than they actually are. And so we look, I want to see what movement they've been doing the past couple of weeks. I want to know what they've been eating the past couple of weeks. Because sometimes people have routine changes and they say they plateaued, but they didn't actually plateau. They just weren't doing the things that they were doing the other 2 weeks. And so, you know, did your vegetables fall off? Are you getting enough fiber? So I think it warrants like a really good analysis before you decide that it's a true plateau. But if you decide it's a true plateau, I really try, if the client's not doing strength training or HIIT exercises, like we try to adjust the movement and maybe take it up a notch or change what they're doing. But if that's not doable, then we may adjust the carbs a little bit, and I might alter the calories like a little bit, but I try not to move the calories too much, because it just becomes unrealistic for people. Like they'll eat then 1,500-1,600 calories, get another drop, and then we're in the same problem or situation as before. So I think working on like building muscle as your foundation, building muscle is important because it increases your metabolism and how many calories you burn at rest. And at rest, meaning if you're just laying in bed and not doing anything for the whole day, you're going to burn more calories if you have muscle on you versus if you don't. And so that's what really helps preserve the metabolism so that you can eat more and get the results that you want. And on the flip side, if you're not doing any strength training, and you, let's say you have a 15-pound weight loss goal, when I get clients to the 15 pounds, they're never satisfied because they're not tight and toned. And so they always feel like they have a little fat on them that they need to get rid of. But when you build muscle and you build a nice foundation like that, you know, you may not even want to, you might be happy before you reach that ideal weight that you want to get to. And so I think, and I'm sure you can back me up on this since you do a lot of training, it seems, that like that's a foundational piece, I think, for health is you got to build muscle.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing because we're constantly fighting this uphill battle of things like Orange Theory, things like HIIT is the best thing, and it's not. It has its place in someone's program. High intensity has its place, but everyone thinks that they have to go out and go balls to the walls and burn 1,000 calories every single day to lose weight because the book says you got to burn 3,500 calories to lose a pound of weight or a pound of weight. And it's not that simple. And people, it's interesting when you get people to start doing strength training from going from nothing, obviously they're going to get results. The really interesting thing, places when you get someone that's going and doing so much HIIT exercise, their adrenals, their whole system is just so taxed all the time, and you back that off and add 2 or 3 days of strength training, everything changes. They got more energy, they're burning more calories, they're losing weight faster, they're doing all of the things just by that one little adjustment in their daily activity or daily stuff that they're doing. And that's why I think that's why I love the power of food, because you add those two components together for all these individuals, all of us who want to lose weight. It's when you add the quality of the food that we're consuming in a strategic way and whatever way works for you in your lifestyle, on top of adding exercise and whatever way is going to work for you, and hopefully you're getting a combination of low, moderate, and high intensity exercise with some type of resistance training, everything starts coming into place. And it's so awesome and cool to see that evolution in someone that, you know, someone that you're working with, someone that I'm working with, someone that is struggling with those issues. And then when I talk about diabetes and we add those components in, now everything changes their blood sugar, just like everything we've been talking about this whole time. And we didn't even get down to the nitty gritty yet of how do you bolus for something? You know, how much time should you, what's the strategies you do with that? How much pre-bolus do you need? How should you be counting carbs? You need to take the previous exercise into account. All of these components that we talk about, there's, you know, 40 plus things that we have, decisions that we have to make every single day. When you take all that into account and then just add those simple thoughts of doing a good, rounded, quality, good program in terms of exercise, but then also just watching the quality of the things that you eat in a strategic way, it's so crazy what happens. So crazy.
Yeah, that's amazing. I actually have a question for you with the exercise, because I think this was a big question of mine because I'm not like an exercise expert. I'm a yoga teacher.
Nice. Good for you. See, but we need that. Yeah, we need yoga, though. We need that stuff. Yeah.
But being in this, I don't currently teach, but I taught for a long time. But being in that space where it's like group classes, you've got Pilates, you've got yoga and all these different things. So my biggest question was like, what is strength training? Because I did bar class for a long time and I thought I was doing strength training, then come to find out that's not really considered strength training. And I was like, what? I thought I was doing that. So what like is considered strength training? Just lifting weights in the gym? Is that like the only thing that's considered strength?
No. So there's different. So people hear the word strength training and they think that they're just lifting and doing resistance training. There's different variations of it, right? You can do strength training in the bar using in what you're talking about, the bar class type thought process, but it's a different adaptation than if you're doing, you know, semi submax loads of whatever your 1RM is or whatever your high intensity of lifting that actual weight is of, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 reps. That is different than doing a bar class, because you're ripping the muscle and you're providing an you're trying to get to an adaptation that's completely different. The high intensity piece is like, we're just trying to burn as much off as possible and get this muscular endurance type idea adaptation, where when we're actually trying to do strength training and actually build real muscle, that happens in a smaller window than doing 1,000 reps of something in a bar class or in an Orange Theory class or in, you know, whatever class it might be, aerobic step class, where we're lifting 5-10 pounds and just doing different variations of exercises, right? So it's about the adaptation that you're trying to get. And to say that a bar class is not strength training, I don't think that's necessarily the right thought process. What the right thought process is that's not strength training to build muscle, because it is technically strength training because you're working on muscular endurance. When I train a client, we're doing different phases, just like how you work with an individual in nutrition, where you might phase things out and do different things to get a different adaptation. You might need to start here. Once you guys accomplish that, now you might, maybe you're adjusting things and like, now you have to go here. It's not always the same. You're always making doing different variations of things to try to get the same result. It's the same idea in strength training and in exercise, because our bodies plateau typically after 2 to 3 weeks of doing the same exact things. That's why we utilize so many different types of methodologies. That's why you should use so many different types of methodologies of low intensity, moderate intensity, strength training, high intensity, and recovery. So when we're talking about building an actual program for something, for someone, it should have those four buckets. That's what I call my four buckets of success. You've got strength training, you've got low intensity, which could be, I'm just going out for a light jog, or I'm going for a walk, and I'm taking a yoga class, I'm taking a Pilates, something that's not increasing your heart rate really high, and probably not even really increasing your heart rate as high as it would in strength training when you're doing like max loads, as an example. Then you have your third bucket is high intensity, and then you have your fourth bucket is recovery and mobility and flexibility and stretching. All taking things from all four of those buckets are so important, because it helps align the system and get you to that adaptation that you want, which is for most people is to get stronger and lose weight, or to get stronger and maintain weight.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really interesting and like makes a lot of sense. So how do I need all my buckets every single week?
you don't need all your buckets every single week, because strength training versus high intensity training are two different buckets that should be done on opposite sides of the spectrum, not opposite sides, but within different phases.
Okay.
Right. So I'm not going to go lift, you know, a semi max load of a squat as an example, and then the next day do high intensity. Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that squat pattern, and that whole entire week is going to be different variations of exercises at that same intensity. The next phase, then maybe I'm doing more high intensity stuff, where I'm still doing a squat pattern, but I'm using lighter weight and I'm doing 10, 12, 15, 20 reps of something, or I'm doing some type of duration, or I'm taking a bar class, something like that. I'm doing that for 2 or 3 weeks. So I look at it as those are on different sides of the spectrum, and I'm utilizing one, what the client's goal is to program this out. But then with that, with both of those sides of the spectrum, throughout the rest of the week needs to have low intensity and it needs to have recovery stuff.
Okay.
Depending on what you're doing and depending on the intensity, right? You come from a yoga perspective, right? Depending on the actual class, if it's a hot yoga, it's high intense, like there's just so many movements, you're getting through all these different ranges of motion. That's not recovery.
Yeah.
But if you're doing a nice flow yoga, it's good mindset work, like great. Like it's just this amazing flowed class that I'm not getting my heart rate high intent. Like my heart rate's not going super, you know, high because it's so intense in terms of the music, the environment, the heat, the flows, like that's not recovery. The low intensity yoga class, that's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
What I always talk about is like I have people come in, we have typically have people come into the gym 3 or 4, maybe 5 days a week, and we'll go, you need to do at least 3 strength training days. If you want to do high intensity days based off of you're in a class, if you're in a class, it's a little bit different than if I'm actually programming for you maybe. So they might do 3 days a week of strength training. Then they need to have at least 2 days of recovery or low intensity days, which we just have people come in. Like I have all my clients come in and they got to walk in zone 1, zone 2 for an hour. Because there's some really good research studies out there that shows, and we know that with the more low intensity work that you can do, the better your aerobic capacity can be, which makes you be able to be more metabolically flexible in terms of your heart rate getting up and it recovering and all these things.
Oh, cool.
So using those 4 buckets in a specific and strategic way, just like you do with food, it's super important to be able to have that idea to be able to do that when you are actually exercising.
Yeah, no, I love
way
that.
Easier said than done.
It sounds very complex. It's also I'm almost getting this vision of looking at it from like a month perspective, like almost backing out of the week view and just looking overall at like what you're doing over the month. Would you say that it's more of like there's just a bigger picture going on there than repeating the same movements every single week?
Yeah. So it's just different things that you can that you can do in that aspect. But then I also put high intensity, depending on what the rest of their week looks like, I'll make them do a zone 4, zone 5 workout, once or twice a week. There's nothing wrong with that. That you're, now we're spilling over the buckets that we said that should be separate.
Yeah.
So it is a complex thing.
Yeah. It sounds like very complex.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome though. It sounds like a really good system. And this is at your gym that you have this?
Yeah, this is at my gym. And most coaches deal within that phasing macro, at least the macro cycle thought process. It's like what we learn from the certifications that we get,
okay,
the education that we get. Just like you guys learning how to, teach someone to count carbohydrates or, how do you, adjust people's macronutrients and caloric intake. It's the same idea.
Okay. No, it's so cool. Thanks for explaining that. That's helpful because I always feel intimidated by strength training and things like that. But I think it's definitely, I've worked with some personal trainers in the past and I have all the workouts written down and stuff like that. So it's really like doable. Do you have any recommendations for like maybe somebody that's listening that wants to do like an online program or anything like that?
In terms of strength training?
Yeah,
they can call us at the Peak Human Performance. We do online training.
Oh, you have online. Perfect.
We do have online training. Okay. Yeah.
All right. So you could link that in the notes, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
All right, cool.
Yeah. So yeah, and that's also part of my 10-week program is like they get access to, I build them an individualized training program. So that's my diabetes program, yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, that's so needed and helpful. Would you have to have a gym, access to a gym for it?
Nope. No.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Yeah. So the difference is because we've talked about two different things with the training aspect, right? We've talked about the strength training piece and the importance of pulling from those four buckets.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, if you can't pull from those four buckets because you don't have access to like weights, now we have to program in a different way. Now we pull more from the high intensity and the low intensity buckets, but they're more body weight and calisthenic exercises that can be done at home. I can build a whole entire program that someone can just do in their house and requires little to no equipment whatsoever. So it's like I always hear that like the thought process of like, oh, I'm intimidated to go to the gym. Great. You don't have to,
mm-hmm.
you know, because exercise should be fun. It yeah. should be enjoyable. And that is also one of the reasons why I think that people gravitate towards running outside, where there's nothing wrong with running outside, but you run on pavement constantly and that's all you're doing. That is a lot of pressure and a lot of stuff coming down on your joints.
Yeah.
And messing up your body. So now you really have to pull from that fourth bucket, the recovery and, you know, mobility and flexibility bucket.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome though. They can be customized and tailored. I think that's really yeah. helpful.
Yeah. I think, and I think it's the same concept with any practice, right? That we're all trying to customize something for the individual, which is why we're all in private practice and not working for the hospitals, working for the corporations, because they all have their own specific procedures that are black and white. You got to do this, this, and this. Just like physical therapists. Like I feel so bad for physical therapists because they're some of the smartest in the exercise industry. They're some of the smartest individuals out there, smarter than doctors for the clinical information or clinicals that they have to go through, the classes they have to go through, how they understand how the body actually works and moves. But they are so handcuffed on what they're allowed to do with individuals because of doctor scripts and insurance. So we unfortunately are creating these really smart individuals that are just robots. And that's what we see in the physical. And that's why so many of them now are getting out into private practice. Just like I've talked to five different dietitians and registered dietitians in the past 2 months on this show that have started clinical work in the hospitals and basically said to themselves, I can't do this anymore. I can't specialize and work with individuals like they actually need because insurance doesn't pay for it, or it's not part of the procedure and the policies and how everything rolls in that world.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
That is frustration.
Yeah. It is a big frustration. It's a big frustration for all of us
mm-hmm.
because who wouldn't like to get a steady paycheck and be able to make this incredible impact and not have to worry about all the other stuff that we have to worry about as entrepreneurs and private practice people.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? Being able to use your own materials is just not even, I worked in like a luxury gym in Washington, D.C. for a while too. And like you were not allowed to use your own materials. And they just, I think it's just like I get it. Somebody could make something incorrect, you know, like they just want to make sure everything's systematic, but it does take away from a lot of like the creativity of the professional and just different ways to teach people.
Yeah. Yeah. The liability piece is an interesting piece too, because there's so many, I feel like there's so many people out there that will take advantage out of a professional that's trying to provide a service to help someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one little thing goes wrong that you're making this assumption based off of the information that you have. Oh, crap, that didn't work. All right, let's go to the next thing,
mm-hmm.
which is the great thing about private practice of what we do. Right, we can look at the whole entire individual. We have time to look at the whole entire individual, and we can make assumptions based off the information that's in front of us, and not feel obligated because of a doctor's note or insurance policy to go even deeper into something different. All you came for me, but for weight loss, but actually, it's a blood sugar problem. We're going to look at that first.
Mm-hmm.
You know
it. Yeah.
unfortunately, in the other realm of what you do and what I do in the health system, that doesn't happen very often, at least I'm not seeing.
Yeah, there's not really enough time on the dietitian's end. Usually it's very little time that you have with the person unless they're an outpatient care. If you're in the hospital setting, you only have a few days with somebody. So it is hard to make any kind of impact.
Yeah. And which is why there's so many blanket statements that are happening in that field, in that realm, that is really like, I feel like just going against the whole entire thought process of what food actually is, or what like good quality food is, or the information that someone should be getting in those specific time frames. Like I talk all the time with people that were just diagnosed with diabetes and they're getting all this information thrown at them when it's all going, they're only grasping maybe 5% of it because they're in such the emotions that are going through them from that diagnosis. Mm-hmm. You can say this probably for any big diagnosis, but the emotions that are going through us in that moment, like we're not holding on to anything that people are saying. I mean, very little. So it's just, let's get used to, it should be, to, for my understanding, it should be, let me get you stable. Let me give you some baseline information about this condition, this disease, this autoimmune disease, whatever it is you have. This is what we believe you have. Here's how you keep yourself safe. We want to see you back in 48 to 72 hours so you have time to process. Now that it's 72 hours later, 48 hours later, now you're back in. You're meeting with all these different specialists, dietitians, endos, whatever it is, and you're getting real information that you can make like adjustments to now. Instead of like, I got to wait 3 months and like I'm struggling because I had no information the first 48 hours given to me. It's crazy to me how the system works.
Yeah, but that is wild. I love that. That would be awesome if people could. And that's such a good point where people need time to process like what they just got diagnosed with. I was a renal dietitian for 6 years. So it's just like that whole process of people just digesting that now they have to be on dialysis. It takes more than a week. It takes like months sometimes. And it's hard. It would be hard for me to educate them even on what they needed to know with nutrition because of all of that emotional stuff coming up. So it's a great point that people don't really point that out, is that there is this whole emotional journey that you're going through whenever you get some sort of diagnosis.
Yeah. Because all we do is look at the symptoms. Mm-hmm. We look at the symptoms and we try to treat the symptoms, which I understand. Like we got to treat the symptoms. We got to keep people safe. But there's a whole nother aspect to the individual and the human being that we're missing on a grand scale, not just the medical system, but on a grand scale, you know? And that's why I love what we do as entrepreneurs and in private practice, because we have the ability to do that. We have the ability to look at the whole entire person, mm-hmm. not just treat a symptom. Yeah. You know, you're not treating a symptom when you get someone. You're trying to understand what the problems are by looking at the symptoms.
Yeah.
You know, and then you're treating the system by treating the whole entire person because of the information that you're getting in front of you.
Yeah, I agree.
That's what I love about it. That's what I love about what we do.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like entrepreneurs always think they can do everything better. Case in point right there.
Yes. And unfortunately, sometimes we can.
Yeah. It's
like, oh, shit, I don't know how to deal with this. I'm going to need to send you to Emily. She can. It's not my school of practice. Emily can help you with this. Oh, gosh. Emily, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for joining me. If you could leave the listeners, we kind of went over this, so I'd be interested to know if there's anything else that has sparked in your brain in this conversation. But if you can give 1 to 3 things and pieces of information to the listeners that they can like put into action right now, is there anything else that we didn't talk about earlier that someone could put into action right now?
I would say, I think we talked a little bit about like meal prep. And yeah. I would say one thing to put into action is to make time for planning. I think that's where people get a little tripped up, is sit down, look at your calendar, mark off all your events, then go through and figure out what you're going to eat. It takes time to be organized. And with blood sugar and consistency, you really want to get organized. And so take the time to set yourself up for success. Figure out what you're going to do for strength training. You know, just take time to think through everything and don't feel like you have to start doing everything right now. If you take 3 days to just explore what systems you can put in place so that you can be more consistent, it can go a really long way. I would say getting organized. I think that's something huge that I see with people. They're just not organized. So they can't, they know what to do. They know the education. It's like, I know what I need to do. I just don't do it. Well, that's because organization is really important.
Yeah. And I love that you bring that up and you say that, because I hear it so many times. Like, I know what to do. I know what I should be doing. And I always ask or say two things to people. Do you really know what to do? Yeah. And two, why are you not doing it? What's holding you back from doing it? And unfortunately, and I had a really good conversation the other day about with a psychologist, a type 1 psychologist. And we were having a really good conversation about this thought process of, it takes a trigger, it takes something to happen in your life for you to take action. And that's such an unfortunate thing as human beings. That's what happens. It takes a diagnosis. It takes a death in the family. It takes whatever that's going to happen for you to take action. And I think what you bring up in terms of being prepared and being organized are so important, because it helps you take action.
Yeah, once you're ready, that's true. Humans are more likely to move away from pain than to move towards pleasure when they view health. So the first step, like you said, I'm glad you brought in the first step, which is just to, you got to have a reason why you're doing this. You got to have motivation, and you have to believe in yourself and know that it takes time, because most people quit after 3 weeks. And I think that's something really important to remember, is you're going to have bumps along the way, but consistency is going to get you really far, and you have to just be patient.
Yeah. 100%. Love it. Well, thank you again, Emily. This was fantastic. Yeah, this was fantastic. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you're still listening, an hour and almost a half through this conversation, thank you for listening. Please make sure that you reach out to Emily. I will have her Instagram handle. I will have her website. I will have all of her contact information in the show notes, so you don't have to worry about searching for Emily. You'll have all of the links to everything that she is offering. Everything will be in the show notes. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and I will see you next time.